Thank you very much. In today's last session, we have a more round table-like setup with three speakers who are going to say a few things about what they've heard today in the previous three panels, but also perhaps add their own ideas to the debate. I'm going to take the speakers in the order they appear on the program. There are lengthy bios in the program, so I'm not going to introduce them formally. So without further ado, I'd ask Professor Lukas Tsourkalis to have the first say.
Do I need this? Oh, yes, we... Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the invitation. Having been the first occupant, so to speak, of the Eleftherios Venizelos chair and also director of the Hellenic Observatory, it is a great pleasure for me, of course, to be able to take part in the celebration. And I should like also to offer my congratulations to Kevin, Spiros, and everybody else involved for a job very well done. So thank you for inviting me to join the celebrations. It is a pleasure to join celebrations, but it is sad to think back what happened to Greece during the last 20 years. A country from the peak of what could be called the Greek success story, when Greece was becoming a modern European country, a member of the core group of the European political system, a country that was gradually acquiring democratic institutions with roots and rising levels of economic prosperity, began tumbling down and ended up in recent years as the weakest link of the euro chain, a most vulnerable one, and often treated as a basket case by a number of friends, partners, allies, and others. So all that hurts a great deal. Of course, as we all know, Greece is and has been for long a country of many contradictions, a country with a cosmopolitan minority, sizable and extremely successful, however, very successful in the arts, sciences, finance, shipping at global level, yet also a country with very large inequalities, a Balkan state, and a political system that with years experienced a steady deterioration in the quality of its members and also became increasingly corrupt. Another kind of contradiction, a country that very often in its modern history managed to be on the right side of history with important strategic decisions taken by political leaders, and in that respect Greece was fortunate enough to have political leaders at crucial moments of its history that realized the direction of the tide and got the country with the tide. Very often against the instinctive reactions of the large majority of the population in the country itself. Yet, and one important example of those strategic decisions is the early decision made by Greece to join the European project, which was one of those strategic decisions that was taken. Yet, interestingly enough, often strategic decisions that the country found it extremely difficult to follow through. And why? I think there are two major explanations for that, historically. One is the traditional weakness of Greek institutions, and the other explanation is that compromise and consensus remain dirty words in the Greek vocabulary. Now, what lessons can we learn from the experience of the last 20 years? The sad experience of the last 20 years. Of course, the title of the conference is Modernization in Europe, obvious, because the term modernization and the strategy of modernization has been traditionally linked to Europe, and this is not only a recent thing. Modernization of the modern Greek state since the days of independence has been directly linked to Europe. And I think throughout the history, if there is one constant, is that whenever modernization crops up as a major political slogan, it is a slogan that is adopted, espoused by political elites, but hardly ever succeeds in taking deep roots in society. So it is modernization that is usually an aspiration of elites without always succeeding in convincing a large section of the population that this is the right thing. Now, another sort of general lesson I think one can draw from the experience of the last 20 years is the absolutely remarkable resistance of Greek society and the Greek political system to change. And this is really something that I think needs to be stressed. Some people argue that Greek society resists change because this is essentially the fault of this economic oligarchy. And you know, oligarchy became a very popular term in recent years. I would be the last person to deny the existence of an economic oligarchy that actually resists change in Greece. But having said that, I would add that it is perhaps the extraordinary multiplicity of small vested interests that keeps Greece from change, and that is much more effective than the oligarchy itself. So this extraordinary network of small vested organized interests that resist change in the country. So in that respect, I feel that Greece has become hostage to those vested interests that ensure immobilism at a time when the world is changing very fast. So it is a country that tries to stay still while the world around it is changing at a very rapid pace. And the other general comment I would make is about modernization and, if I may say so, Europeanization at the European level. You know that there were many theories and many books written on Europeanization back, mostly in the 1990s, after the fall of the Iron Curtain. The idea somehow that membership of the European Union through the adoption of the so-called acquis, but also through osmosis, would lead to a gradual convergence of institutions, standards, norms towards the higher level presented by more developed Western European countries. So people expected that this process of Europeanization, and that was the main thing of the European Union, would raise the standards and get countries from first the southern periphery and then the eastern periphery of Europe converge towards standards often implicitly set by the West. Now, the experience suggests that at best, that's my conclusion at least, Europeanization is an extremely slow process that operates with fits and starts, which means that countries resist change that comes from outside and above. And this is not only the experience of Greece, but look at what is happening in some of the Central and Eastern European countries today. If I were, and I'm not, but if I were very cynical, I would say that in some countries of Central and Eastern Europe, leave aside the rising levels of prosperity, what we risk experiencing is a straight transition from communism to kleptocracy and then to fascism. But I'm not cynical and I would never say that. Now, what is the experience then with the memoranda? Because that's a more recent and the saddest part of the story. Now, I'm convinced that Greece's experience with the process of adjustment, with the three memoranda, is a case study that should be and will be increasingly studied in universities across the globe as an example of things that should not be done. It is, therefore, Greece will be a case study of what needs to be avoided for other countries that will follow. And why? First of all, of course, we know and we heard today that Greece's starting point was an impossible starting point, because Greece had an impossible combination of budget deficits, current account deficit, plus a deficit of credibility, because we discovered somehow that part of the Greek political class had been, that's my diplomatic expression, economical with the truth and creative in the use of statistics. So the combination of all those three deficits plus the accumulated debt meant that unless you believed in extraterrestrial economics, that adjustment was going to be long and painful. Okay, so Greece, from where it started in 2009, it had to go through a very painful adjustment, much more painful than Ireland, Spain, Portugal, and the rest. But on top of that, what happened was that Greece's lenders imposed a program that was unrealistic in several respects. It was unrealistic, first of all, in the assumption about the kind of front-loaded macroeconomic adjustment that Greece was required to make. To use jargon, they underestimated the fiscal multipliers massively, either underestimate them or decided that they were not prepared to finance, to increase the finance, so that was the only option. And even worse, the belief somehow that the country that required massive change, no doubt, could do the massive change imposed from outside in a very short period of time. So Greece's creditors came up with comprehensive reform programs, and when the Greeks did not meet the standards, and I will come back to what we did or did not do, they raised the standards even more. So my conclusion to that, there seems to be some logic in madness. So you ask somebody to do the impossible, and if he or she fails to do the impossible, you add more. Now, let me be a bit more specific and more self-critical for my own countrymen. Again, I think one thing to draw as conclusion is that Greece, as a society, as a political system, faced with this very long and painful process of adjustment that was necessary. What we can discuss is how front-loaded it would be, how much can you change in 1, 2, 3, 4 years, started with a state of denial. So a large part of the Greek political system, backed by Greek society, simply refused reality. They implied, assumed that adjustment was not necessary, that somehow there was some magical pill, potion, that you could drink and you would solve the problem. And this state of denial was accompanied by very limited ownership of both the macroeconomic adjustment program, even more so of the reform program. And what I think is remarkable and tragic is that today, 6 years after the beginning of the first adjustment program, Greece remains still unable to agree even on the basics of a national exit plan from the crisis. And that is the most tragic thing to conclude. I mean, 6 years in the crisis, the Greek political system, and not only the political system, the society that backs that political system, is unable to agree even on the basics of what is required to take the country out of it. Now, and of course in the process, the economy imploded, as we all know, and then the political system imploded. And then again, not surprisingly, in the vacuum created by the implosion of the old political system, imperfect though it was, the vacuum was largely filled by demagogues. And this is the reality today. Now, this is on the Greek side, so I went through my necessary collective self-criticism. Now, on the creditors' side, the creditors' partners' side, I talked before about a dogmatic approach and a punishing mood combined, which created and presented Greek politicians with a virtually impossible program, because not only the macroeconomic adjustment, the reform packages that were imposed on Greece had virtually no prioritizing, as if any political system can introduce massive change in a short period of time and survive in a democracy. And that's madness. And what is even worse is that increasingly, Greece's creditors began to treat Greece as a colony. And this is the case even today. And this has created a vicious circle, and the vicious circle consists of lack of the credibility of the Greek politicians that feed into the colonial attitude of the creditors, and it is a vicious circle that continues and gets deeper. Now, this is a terrible vicious circle, and it is terrible not only for Greece. We have paid a huge price and we will continue to pay a huge price. But it is also terrible for Europe, because this is not what the European Union was meant to be. So the experience of Greece and its relationship to its creditors in recent years has been traumatic, absolutely traumatic, not only for the country, but also for Europe as a whole. Now, the key question is how to break this vicious circle. And I'm sorry to end with this note. I do not see as yet the conditions in either Greece or on the creditor side and the willingness to break that vicious circle. So until we do break that circle, we will be in very deep trouble. Thank you.
I'm very honored to be here. I'm neither an academic nor a politician, so I'm wondering why I've been invited, but I won't wonder too much. In this last panel, we were told that we should not have ready-made presentations, but rather we should comment on what has been said earlier. And I appreciate that. It's an easier task, in a sense. And as I was listening to what was being said, I picked out four titles that I want to comment on. The four titles are... The first one is what I would have commented on anyway, which is the nature of Greek modernization as corporatism. The second title came out of the discussions today about why there seems not to have been a big political coalition in favor of modernization. And this has to do, in my opinion, among other things, with the nature, the structure of the Greek middle class. So my second item is about the structure of the Greek middle class. My third, I heard a lot of pessimism, especially in the economics panel today, about how Greek private sector can grow, given the fact that massive amounts of investment need to flow into the country in order to grow. And I'm going to counter that narrative, saying we can still grow even without massive amounts of investment, which is Plato was calling for some sort of positive narrative. And finally, if I have time, I will also talk about positive narratives in the public sector, about reforms in the public sector. Now, about the nature of modernization as corporatism. My own potted version of what happened from 96 to, let's say, the next 8 years is that the faction of PASOK, led by Prime Minister Simitis, managed to conquer populism and sort of push aside marginalized populism by substituting that with corporatism. Populism was a system of handouts to anybody that asked for them. It was a system of macroeconomic laxity, irresponsibility, fiscal deficits, inflation, etc. And it also had a narrative of anti-elitism. The people were the good people. Anybody who made money was bad. Now, the project of the PASOK modernization, as I understood it at the time and still understand it, was to some extent to say that, look, we need macro stability, especially fiscal discipline, parenthesis, interestingly, not current account discipline. It didn't seem like the current account deficit was a big issue at the time, but fiscal deficits were big issues, and the government decided to impose discipline on that. The fact that the public sector should be working according to some sort of coherent planning and coherent processes, the famous blockade that the Prime Minister used to hold, that was, you know, many people were at the time ironic about that, but the fact that ministries had to deliver specific deliverables was quite new in the Greek context. And also that there could be some sort of incomes policy, which was determined by some sort of collective wage bargaining, or rather three-part bargaining, including the state. Now, this type of corporatism had a lot of promise in it. But there was one thing missing, one crucial ingredient missing in this corporatism, which was the role of competition in fostering innovation and increasing productivity. It was a protected, inward-looking, introvert, I should say, corporatism. Now, I believe that the modernizing group had the Northern European social democracy as a model, and were hoping, with some adjustments, to emulate that in Greece. There was, however, one major structural difference between Northern European social democracy and the Greek economy. And this was that the large corporations of Northern Europe, the most powerful ones, were in manufacturing, and therefore they were exporters, and they were in the tradable sectors. So all regulation and all collective bargaining in Northern Europe had one constraint, that it should not hinder and it should even support the competitiveness of the manufacturing sector of those countries. And Sweden and Finland and Germany and so on have managed the feat of having superior welfare states and very high taxation, but still being leading exporters. And the share of exports in the GDP of those countries is among the highest in the world, perhaps the highest in the world. In the Greek case, we did not have corporations in the tradable sectors, very few. What did we have? We had the banks, we had the DECO, the OTE, et cetera, et cetera, the public utilities, which were partly privatized, and we had the contractors of the public works. Now, all of these are non-tradable businesses. They're businesses that are not threatened by international competition, or at least they can be protected by from international competition. Now, this led to the following paradox, that the business interests that were dictating policy, labor legislation or taxation, were business interests that didn't care, didn't need to care about what was happening in the rest of the world. And this was one of the reasons why, while very many things improved in the economy during that period, the current account did not improve. There was no real push to boost exports in Greece. Current account had always been in huge deficit in Greece. It remained during the modernization period, and it became worse later on. And what happened, in addition from capital flowing in because of the run-up to joining the Eurozone, and after we joined the Eurozone, there was a lot of capital flowing in the country, and this was sustaining the current account deficit. In addition to that, what we had was a bargain among labor and the employers in the non-tradable sectors, in the banks and the INOT, et cetera, which created a system of labor laws which were fine for the workers there, but when this system was also required to be imposed in the manufacturing sector, for example, or in the tourism sector, this couldn't function. And this was one of the reasons why manufacturing never revived in Greece, and it kept, you know, diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. So we went into the crisis eventually with essentially no tradable sectors at all except for tourism. To make a parenthesis here, about the narrative of the crisis, when the crisis started, I talked about the difference between the fiscal deficit and the current account deficit. When the crisis started, it was not just the Greek discourse that was saying it was the public sector that is at fault. It was the German discourse as well. Remember, the Germans wanted to paint this crisis as a government debt crisis, whereas in reality it was a current account crisis, a balance of payments crisis. It was the fact that our debt was owed to foreign agents, not to Greeks. This served the German narrative well, because the Germans did not want to get into a discussion of current account imbalances within the Eurozone. The narrative was always that within the Eurozone, current account deficits do not matter, and current account surpluses, which is what Germany is interested in, also do not matter. So this created, in my view, a false narrative right from the beginning, which to some extent has carried over into the structure of the memoranda. Instead of focusing on how to increase exports primarily, we focused on how to trim down or to trim down the fiscal deficits primarily. These two are not incompatible. Actually, they can work together, but it is an issue of where you place priorities. And we ended up with what Lukas was saying, a huge program of 100 different reforms that should be enacted, whereas we should have been prioritizing. Now, my second item, on the structure of the Greek middle class. Why didn't the middle class really get behind the Tsimitis project and support it? Let me define middle class here as the people who have some sort of agency over their economic life without having much capital. Okay, the capitalist has agency because he holds capital. The working class really gets whatever job they're offered. The middle class are the people who can somehow choose a career, which means that they usually have some ownership, μια περιουσία, but they also have human capital. They have education, they have different views of the world, and they can choose what to become to some extent. Now, in Greece, because our corporate sector is minute by the standards of any other European country, we have small businesses. This means we do not have many white-collar jobs, employee jobs, I mean, middle management or lower management job. There are very, very few of those jobs in Greece in the private sector. In the West, it is these jobs that were the backbone of the middle class. What we have instead in Greece is small shop owners, some public sector employees who are middle class, and a lot of professionals, doctors, lawyers, etc., etc. Now, in a period of structural change, the segment of the middle class that can be pro-innovation, pro-productivity, pro-change, is the people who work in corporations. Why? Because the personal skill of somebody who works in a corporation is not directly identified with the product of the corporation. You can be a very good sales executive and one year be selling imported cosmetics, and the next year you can be selling exported olive oil. As long as the economy is doing well, you don't really mind switching from one type of product to the other type of product. If you're a small merchant and have your magazine in Eolu, if Eolu closes down, there's nothing much you can do. It needs a lot of time to get into a new type of business. The same is if you're a doctor or a lawyer. Can a doctor, somebody provide another type of service which is not related to medicine? Maybe, but it's very hard. So self-employed tend to be conservative about structural change in the economy. And of course, public sector workers tend to be conservative about structural change. So what was happening in Greece, we were trying to modernize without having the type of middle class that would be pro-structural change. But having this memory of a middle class, in my opinion, still is an advantage in Greece. Under some conditions, those people who have seen their professions shrink can regain agency, can build new careers and new businesses. And this is my third point, the future of the private sector. I think there are ways to build new businesses, new profitable, productive businesses that do not require too much financial capital flowing into the country. Of course, it's great if we can get foreign direct investment in the form of large plants or of investing in tourism, in manufacturing, in agriculture, etc. I would certainly welcome that. But you can also have new businesses starting from people whose investment has already been made in their education or in their grandfather's field somewhere or in the second home that they have built on an island. Now, these people, again, in order to get moving, do need to have some sort of bank credit. So getting bank credit flowing into the economy, again, is, of course, essential. And they also need to face a reasonable tax regime. The tax regime that has been instituted in these last few years against the middle class, on what we call middle incomes, let's say incomes above 30,000 gross per year, is insane. It is absolutely insane, and it's not going anyway to produce much fiscal inflow. But in my view, this is relatively easy to change. So if you change the tax regime and if you get some money flowing through the banks, I believe those people can create new businesses. And let me give you some examples. First of all, we do have some physical capital that can be, as they say in business, repurposed. We have a lot of agricultural land that is being used very unproductively, and you don't really need much physical investment to get it moving more productively. You need organization and personal investment, investment of time, of knowledgeable people. In healthcare, both the public sector and the private sector invested insane amounts of money over 20 or 30 years in building hospitals and iatria and MRI scanners and CAT scanners, et cetera, et cetera. We have the highest number of doctors in the world per capita after Cuba. We have everything we need in order to make our medical sector exportable, and there is now, it's becoming globalized. Medical services are becoming globalized. This is what I would say is a prime example of repurposing capital. Things that you did for a different reason are there, and you can use them with a different business model. And finally, and most importantly, it's this vague idea of a vague term, the knowledge economy, which encompasses anything from technology startups. I know about technology startups because my business is to invest in those. Anything from technology startups to medical services, to engineering services in projects in Dubai, et cetera, et cetera. Even including some knowledge in food production or in food processing. Simple things like that, which do not require huge R&D expenditures, but need mostly organization and people willing to take risks, are there to be taken as an opportunity for Greece. It's already happening on a small scale. When I started with my partners at Open Fund investing in very early stage technology startups in 2012, there was almost nothing there. Now the ecosystem of startups in Athens and in Thessaloniki and in Crete is quite vibrant, and we are going to see employment increasing. We have a few multinationals that are setting up big R&D centers in Athens. I don't know how many of you know that Nokia has its biggest R&D center in the world in Athens. It's employing 100 Greek engineers in Athens for research and development. Now, people in Israel have been telling me that one major source of employment in Israel is models like that. Big multinationals like Microsoft, Google, etc., going to Israel and setting up research and development centers. And how has this happened? To some extent, it has happened in the following way. An Israeli executive in Microsoft reaches the age of 50. He's had his career, 50, 55. He's made a lot of money. He wants to go back to his home country. And he convinces the company to let him set up an R&D center in Israel, initially, you know, getting 10, 20, 50 engineers, and eventually, if this produces well, it grows. Now, you don't need any huge direct investment projects to implement this model. You start small. You just need people who want to do it. And when people produce interim results, every year something better, you can get funding. You can do it in the startup business. You can do it in the multinational R&D business, as I've said. So, here you are. I think that we can have a growing economy, a growing private sector, without huge inflow of financial capital. Have I got two more minutes? Okay. So my fourth point has to do with modernization in the public sector. I think it was Dimitri Sotiropoulos who said, and it was Calliope as well, that the modernization of the public sector as it was attempted, there were a lot of things done in terms of processes, in terms of setting up new institutions, anexarchites, arches, and so on, which was great. But most people were not enthralled by it. They did not own it. They didn't see how that would affect their own lives. And perhaps this was why Themeli said that the only thing that will remain as a memory from our period is Tatsimenda. Actually, thinking about it, I hadn't heard of it, but I think he was right. Very, very few people today are saying that what happened, the changes in the public sector during the Simitis era actually affected their lives positively. And I think the reason is because most of the effort was in what was happening inside, but very little was done in order to improve what we in technology call the user experience, how the users perceive the changes. Now, there's one notable exception to this, and people mentioned it today, TAKEP. TAKEP were loved by people because they saw immediate positive change in their everyday life. They didn't have to sit in queues in all the ministries and all the nomarchies and all the euphories. They could just do it by just walking into a cab in 5 minutes and having a smiling employee talk with them, etc., etc. Now, I think if we had that mentality in other sectors as well, this could make people embrace the reforms. And for me, one obvious example is the national health system. I was very, very surprised and enthralled in 2012, London Olympics opening ceremony. What did they choose to show when we were showing our glorious history? They showed the NHS, because the British people know that the NHS works for them, and they're proud of that. I think we could do it in Greece. But this means that when you design social services like that, you have to say that the main thing I want to achieve is improve the user experience, what the person feels from the first day he walks into the hospital until he gets out. And we haven't been doing that. So this is one way, and you need political space for that as well, of course. But I think this is one way in which to get people on the side of reforms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I think you know why we invited you to come and speak. Pastor Mavrides.
Well, I'm not a politician. I'm not an academic. I'm neither an entrepreneur. So why did you invite me? So thank you very much for being here. I learned a lot and gave me a lot to think about it. And what I've seen today in today's event was optimism and very much disappointment. I was, Mr. Simidis concluded that there is a new generation of politicians, of there is a part of society that will take modernization going. And there was following by Mr. Pappas, who said about continuous modernization failures in Greece. And I think they are both right. There is big community of modernizers in Greece in every profession, politicians, economists, academics, journalists and stuff. And they will try again. But I think that I'm afraid that we'll end up in failure. And that's because modernization in Greece was never a popular demand. In the mid-70s, when Konstantinos Karamanlis was asked how ready was the Greek society to be in the European Union, European Economic Corporation back then, said something that describes the whole history of modernization in Greece. Actually, till 2010, I will throw them in the sea and they will be forced to swim. He didn't ask. He didn't consider. He didn't care. He didn't explain. Neither we did. It was a top-down modernization, as Mrs. Kalliopis Panou said. And I will disagree with Mr. Pagoulatos, who said that there was weak demand and supply of reforms. There was too much supply of reforms and very weak demand. What we had in Greece was an enlightened leadership, Western-minded, Western-studied, most of them. After all, and they were applying to an Eastern-minded population. And the divide that Mr. Nikiforos Diamandouros writes about between the Eastern-minded and the Western-minded Greece is not a social division. It's actually a division between academic, political, journalistic elite and society. In 2010, we, the elites, found ourselves in a terrible situation. The two weapons that we had to override society all these previous years and push modernization, they didn't exist. Which was the two weapons that we had? Before the years between 50 and 74 was coercion, where Greece was modernized because it didn't have complete democracy. Konstantinos Karamanlis could do everything he wanted without caring much about the sensitivities of the populace or anything else. From 74 till 2010, we were bribing society through clientelism. Every politician here knows that if he wanted a union not to oppose something, he would hire the public sector, the daughter of the president of the union. So till 2010, in 2010, we the elites, we are finding in a position that we don't have the money to bribe the society, or bribe the unions, or bribe wherever else, but we're a democratic society after all, and cannot use coercion. So what do? We cry to each other's shoulders. And we are wondering what went wrong in the referendum and showed that we are a minority. Referendum showed exactly what Greek society is, 62-38. And 38 is not a genuine 38 because there was fear between the populace. We are less than 38%. In 2002, Mr. Simitis, he was elected again president of PASOK. He was the only candidate, and he took in his party 70%. Is that right, Mr. Simitis? 2002 it was, I guess. 70% in his own party, and he was the only candidate. That was not PASOK. PASOK succeeded so long in the Greek political society because he depicted the Greek society very well. It's not that PASOK created another society. PASOK was depicting the Greek society. So, what do we do now? Right now that we are speaking in this wonderful venue of LSE, or as we do a lot of times in a Brevoir restaurant in Kolonaki, Athens. In my neighborhood, Kypseli, in my neighborhood, Kypseli, where I go and drink my coffee, members of Golden Dawn and Soros party, there's a new party going on in Greece now, Soros party, that promises that will erase all borrowing and stuff like this, they're going to cafeterias and speak to the people. We don't do that anymore. We don't understand that this, the populace down there, people down there, they don't understand the basic issues of democracy. I was amazed. I'm a heavy user of social media. And I was amazed in the period of 2010 and 2000 till today how many young people that were interacting with me, they didn't understand that violence is the opposite of democracy. They thought that for achieving democracy, we should use violence. They didn't understand the concept of human rights. They didn't understand why they shouldn't go in a university and interrupt a discussion like this. We won the ID battle about religion, and we lost every battle ever since. Why? Because this battle was not won on ideological form, in an ideological ground. It was won in the political ground. People do not understand why the church should be separated by the state. They don't understand it. They don't understand why minorities should have rights. These are the basic issues that we don't teach to the people. First of all, we journalists. I mean, we should criticize ourselves because we don't. Actually, well, in many occasions, especially in television, we teach the opposite. We spoke all these years about justified violence. We spoke about what these foreigners talk about this. But I think it's our obligations to go out and speak for the basics, not the complicated that we're speaking right now here. Thank you.
Plenty of time for questions and discussion. So would anybody like to ask a first question or make a comment?
Hi, my name is Agilos Agelou. I'm striving to do my PhD here in the LSE. I want to tap on something that Mr. Doxiadis brought up at the end of his presentation, the perception of having bad user experience. I take that as meaning that many Greeks, even before the crisis, they thought that they didn't get the adequate amount of services they paid for through their taxes. I get the argument. So when you find yourself in such a system, you have three choices. Either you exit, you stay in the system, loyalty, or you voice your concerns. So the thing is, in Greece, we see mainly people exiting the system, going to the private sector to take this kind of services, or staying in the system, loyalty, and trying to make work via informal means. So my question to you is, why do you think we didn't see any kind of organized voice towards having better public services? And what's even more puzzling to me is that if we agree that we have a populist system, which actually, you know, follows the public perception, follows the public views, we would expect this kind of voice for a better public sector to be even more effective. You know, politicians should have an incentive in such a system to really follow this kind of incentives. So I'm not sure why we don't see loyalty in the Greek system. And it's not about the crisis, it's even before the crisis.
Let's have a second question. Please, the gentleman over here on this side.
Hi, my name is Yanis Sofanos. A simple question. We didn't speak about the big elephant in the room, Syriza and the current government. What should we expect from them? To leave soon or to stay and make the mess bigger?
One more question?
I'm Helena Smith. I write for The Guardian out of Athens. I was quite intrigued by something that my colleague Paskos Mandravelis mentioned. And it took me back to a conversation we had had many years ago that the Greek media, the one story it missed, was the biggest story, and that was the story of the crisis in Greece and mea culpa as well. You know, it suddenly all hit us, and but we hadn't reported on it before. Bashkos today mentioned Golden Dawn. I think the only panel member today to mention this party. And in the age of demagogy, I wondered whether you were worried whether the story of Golden Dawn is going to be a story that we will miss again. It's obviously retrenching, being nourished by this crisis in the years ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take those three first. Arista, maybe we should start with you.
Okay. There was a question about exit, voice, and loyalty, I suppose. Why didn't people insist on the improvement of public services? First of all, I think voice, in order to be effective, needs somebody to synthesize it. Most of the voice we had about the bad hospital system had to do with dissatisfaction. It was people were saying, you know, we're not being treated well in the hospital, but then it was not up to the user to say what they would like to happen or how it could happen. And somebody needs to take this dissatisfaction and turn it into some sort of positive project. And this has to be a politician. I think the answer to why this did not happen by politicians is twofold. One is the clientelism that a lot of people referred to before. Reforming the hospital system, for example, would require making breaking a lot of eggs with a lot of people who had interests in maintaining the system as it was, from doctors who were taking fakelaki to pharmaceutical companies that were selling drugs at very, very high prices and at very inflated quantities. And the transition from that into a system where everybody would be able to have their operation done quickly, et cetera, takes time, and politicians didn't want to go into this calculation of short-term pain versus long-term benefit. Now, the other reason, I think, why voice was not very effective is because exit, to some extent, was relatively easy. People could get reimbursed from their TAMIA for the drugs that the doctors were prescribing. Primary health care was being left to the private sector doctors, who would also be reimbursed from ICA, et cetera, et cetera. So exit was made easy for the consumer of health services. Even though on an economic level this was not sustainable, it didn't seem so at the time. Now, the other two questions. Syriza, would I prefer to go sooner to stay? There's some issue of political tactics, and I think it would really, it's not really a matter of a conference like this to get bogged into discussions of tactics. On the question of Golden Dawn, I like to think that it has plateaued at some stage, at this stage. I like to think that the extreme failure of Syriza to deliver on its populist promises has sent the message to most people, not everybody, of course, to most people, that it was the dream of having some sort of different economy was an illusion, and it was not an issue that of people, of personalities, that Tsipras cannot deliver, whereas perhaps Michaloliakos can deliver. My sense is that this is not how it's played out. It's playing out, but this is just a personal sense.
Let me. Does this work? Let me deal briefly with a question about Syriza. You referred to Syriza as the big elephant in the room. Of course, we all know that Syriza started as an anti-systemic party. It promised to change Greece and to change Europe, both. And so it promised a better life and an alternative to memoranda that were painful, to Greek society. That was one side of the story. And the other side of the story was that it criticized and denounced a previous system that was deemed to be corrupt and now bankrupt. Now, the first side, the promise of a better life, is not materializing. Okay? And they certainly have been unable to change Europe and unlikely to do so. If Greece had the negotiating power in 2010, potentially, by threatening to be the kamikaze that blows himself up and the rest of Europe, that threat of a kamikaze is no longer a credible threat today, because the rest of the Eurozone can, well, with some cost, but still they believe they can insulate themselves from the kamikaze. They could not insulate themselves if Beppe Grillo comes to power in Italy. Mm. Italy is a different kettle of fish. But Syriza still has another argument, which it uses all the time, and this is the denunciation of the previous system. Look at the argument they use with the television channels. They say, what was the previous system? An unlawful situation, people running television channels without any licenses by corrupt people who were involved, I mean, the famous Diabloki. So far, the analysis is not far from the truth. The trouble is that what they are proposing may end up being even worse than the previous system, because there is the risk of moving from Diabloki to mafia land. All right? So, but the argument that relies on denunciation of the previous system still has some mileage. And if you want my prediction, I don't think they will rush to get out of the scene, because I don't see any reason why they should if I were them.
Luca, would you like to say a couple of words about the dawn as well?
Yes, I don't know whether it's wishful thinking or analysis, but I share Aristos's view that Golden Dawn may have reached the plateau. Because if they could not increase substantially their share of the vote at the peak of the refugee crisis, I don't know when the hell they can. But of course, there is a different kind of medium-term risk. People, rightly or wrongly, many people in Greece, have invested their hopes in the alternative provided by Syriza. Now, that alternative is not materializing. I don't know what many of the voters of Syriza will do next. Will they stay at home? Will they start throwing stones? I mean, you know, disappointment, continuous disappointment, is dangerous. So, but will Golden Dawn be the one that capitalizes on that? Perhaps unlikely. At least I hope so.
Yes. First of all, this is not the only story we've missed, the Greek story we've missed. And I'm not talking about only about journalism and the media. The whole elites missed that story. Yeah. The media, missed the story of the crisis, but the political system missed it, the academics missed it, there were not voices about the crisis. Another story we've missed is the racism in Greek society, something that we never discussed. The big motto was that Greeks are not racist by default. And we saw the results. So, about Golden Dawn. You know who is the biggest enemy of Golden Dawn from ground research in Kypselis Kafenia now? Soros. That's the biggest enemy of Golden Dawn. The people who voted for Golden Dawn will vote for Soros. And that...
This is good.
Yeah, that's good. And I hope so. But, you know, their alternative, their hope, reaction to the political system, instead of the reactionary reaction to the political system, will be Soros. About Syriza, I'm confused. I mean, they vote everything, and that's good. Because as Mr. Christodoulakis said, let's go over with the third memorandum so not to have a fourth one. But they're not applying. And this is the biggest problem with the political system.
Mr. Christodoulakis said about the trucks liberalization of the market. You know what happened with the liberalization of the market with trucks? We have public plates and private plates trucks. They voted the liberalization that if you have a truck with private plates, you can hire it and do a movement. What they did, they voted that, and then in another law, they passed an amendment that said that if you want to hire a private plate truck, you have to hire it for 2 years minimum. So if you want to move your house, your furniture from one house to another, you will hire a public plate truck. That happened to every liberalization of the market. Little amendments that no one knows, that happened, you know, to see it. There, little amendments that no one knows, and we don't have a free market yet. As for the milk, as I said to Mr. Christodoulakis, we now buy milk at 0.8 euros per liter, which used to be 1.4, 1.5. So, I forgot something to say that. We are saying all the time about the weakness of Greek institutions. Why all Greece has weak institutions? Because there is not social support for that. Whereas institutions are socially supported, they're never weak. That's why, because they were imposed, they were planted from above, and people never understood their use to it. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take another round of questions. First, Dimitris Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much. I have a slightly provocative comment that came out of Lukas's presentation, which I thought was excellent. And we talk a lot, and today we spoke an awful lot about the limits of Europeanization, the limits of modernization, and how hollow, perhaps, this process has been over the years. But there is something to be said about its resilience as well. And let's not forget that in 2005, post-referendum, there was a very comfortable majority for Syriza having committed to the third bailout. And I mean, if you try and think of it comparatively, if one had applied what has been applied to Greece, and you explained that very well, where would that country be right now? I mean, I live in England, and I saw how a mature democracy has been destabilized by crises that were a fraction of what we have witnessed in Greece. So perhaps, I know it's late in the day, we should also reflect on the fact that Europeanization and pro-Europeanism in Greece is possibly stronger than we often think.
I have a short question for each. First, at Paschos, we have to consider that maybe Greece was among the first to introduce post-truth politics, and we can ask John Sprouse about this. Secondly, on Aristos, what he says is that we have all the constituent parts of building a robot that a Frankenstein that can lead us out of the crisis. What we need is someone to breathe life into it. And whilst we are waiting, the problem is that this development is taking place, but it has already exited. So what I'm afraid is that the sort of development that Aristos is evangelizing is already taking place, but it's taking place in London. So the young people, rather than setting up their business in Greece, they're taking their parents' money, some of the 40 billion that is under mattresses and things, and setting up businesses in the UK or basically outside Greece as an expression of the exit. I mean, so they, which is again, it's a function of not having a narrative to impress them to stay. And finally, for Lukas, aren't the Europeans also exiting? Is the quality of intervention of European engagement in the third memorandum much lower than it was before? Isn't in this post-Brexit world that the problem child is no longer Greece, but Britain.
Okay, let's take one more question. George Pavoulatos.
Thank you. In my presentation, I did my best to fake a degree of optimism that I'm not sure I exactly can justify. So maybe now, off record, I can share with you my deep concern. Just by looking at, you know, the picture of Greece from outside, you have a pretty horrific story for anyone with any understanding of history, sociological dynamics, anyone who has read about the 30s or whatever. And the fact that this has become a cliche by the Syriza people does not mean that we need not take it very seriously, especially since we are in a world that is experiencing the rise of those who believe that they have been left behind. With the numbers of unemployment, rising inequality, poverty, brain drain has a double damage because Greece loses the best minds and the most creative people, those who are ready to respond to the exit voice and loyalty question by, in fact, investing. And not only it loses the best, but it's also left with the worst. It's left with the voters of Mr. Kamenos and the others. And I very much feel in this nice sort of comfortable group therapy session of liberals of all kinds and hues that we are missing a big picture, that there is a growing plurality. I'm not sure if I could call it a majority, but maybe I would, in our society and in other societies as well, who feel that the system is not working for them. And we are forgetting, committed as we are, to the opportunities that the European process creates and liberal values sustain and reproduce, that there is, in every society, there tends to be a majority of people who value security more highly than they value freedom or opportunity, especially when they feel that they cannot rely on their future pension, that they are losing or will lose their job, that their children will never get a job, and all this coming at the same time when the surrounding environment becomes even more difficult to read and even more unfriendly and foreign and something that they don't feel comfortable with. So my question to you is, how can we go back to what was actually the foundation of our entire post-war model in Europe, in Greece, in democracy, this idea that middle class creates democracy, which goes back to Barrington Moore, who goes back to Marx. This middle class had a certain confidence in its future and was thus able to invest in its country. Now we have a growing plurality of people who feel completely in despair. They have nothing to hope for. And the fact the flight of so many of the Syriza voters is something that, you know, if we were just narrow-minded tacticians, we would applaud because, yes, the populists are getting the lesson that they deserve. But in fact, these people have actually sort of confessed that there's nothing that they can really hope for in their political system and in their society. And this is profoundly alarming and dangerous. The fact that we are moving to societies that have a majority, almost a majority, that feels there has no stake in the system. So my question to you is, how do we go back to some sort of, not the two-thirds society, which at back in the 80s some people were in fact criticizing it because they thought it was if you have only two-thirds prospering in a society, that's very bad because one-third is left behind. Today we are in a reverse two-third. And how do we get back? I mean, how do we manage to trickle down the prosperity that is undoubtedly being created by globalization, either trade or financial globalization? How do we manage to reintegrate the losers, those who perceive themselves as losers? Populism has done a significant job in doing that. If these people are not integrated, even by a populist party that gradually moves towards the more of the mainstream, then those who will integrate it are those who will give them a baton and have them, operate as its thugs on the streets, beating up immigrants. How do we do that? A very small, simple, and ambitious question.
Okay. Since we are running out of time, I know that there are some people who want to ask a question, so I'm going to take two more questions, and then we're going to ask our panel to address whichever bits of the conversation they wanted. Thank you so much.
I want to jump on that, actually. Yeah, I want to jump on what George said, going back. What does it mean? Back where? To where?
Sure. Back to where?
Because if you read this, the first page of this beautiful, pamphlet of the Hellenic Observatory, what we see here is that 20 years back, the title of a paper here was, are there any chances for modernism, for reformism in Greece, υπάρχουν προοπτικές εξυγχρονισμού στην Ελλάδα? Fast forward 20 years, today, the question is exactly the same. So going back to where? When modernization failed to begin with? Because 20 years back, we're talking about exactly the same things we're talking about today. And I very much doubt what Lucas said, that in the mid-1990s, Greece was at the peak of her success story. I don't know. What was the success story? There was optimism. I agree with that. But success story? And if we had a success story, why do we have this failure today? Why do we have this huge, humongous crisis? We cannot get out of it. Thank you very much.
Nikos Christodoulakis? No? Okay. Okay, we'll stop there now. Luca, can I ask you to kick off this round of answers? I know you're writing an essay there, but maybe you can...
Okay. Can I have your mic? This doesn't work. Sorry. not modernized yet. Okay. Let me try. First of all, if somebody had told me 10 years ago that Greece would go through the crisis that we went through and the country would lose 26% of its GDP and reach an unemployment rate of 27%, which is probably close to 50% for the young people, what would the political consequences of that be? And I would say the end of democracy. So, luckily, nobody posed that question to me 10 years ago, so I didn't have to give that pessimistic answer. So there is a bit of good news also, that despite all the disaster that we have experienced, we have more or less, a democracy. And if I see what is happening in some better families than ours, including the United Kingdom, the United States, and see political developments there, it makes me feel comfortable because, Greece is not the only country where there's absolute mess and political disaster. I mean, this country is inflicting upon itself one of the greatest injuries for decades in a democratic society. Britain, a sophisticated, well-organized country, we discover that the proponents of Brexit had not even thought of what would be the consequences if they win. Some of them seem to be in what other senior members of the Conservative Party refer to them as being in pathological conditions about their understanding of the world. The United States went even further and elected the people that it has elected. So, join a happy world. So that's the first statement to make. Now, let me say one or two more words about Greece, and then I move on to the more general problem. I'm trying to find my notes here. So Greece is still a democracy, but in deep trouble. You could possibly look at Greece as some kind of a vulnerable outpost of an overextended empire that is being increasingly fragmented and with its neighborhood on fire. Greece as the vulnerable outpost of an overextended European empire that is going through the worst crisis since the very beginning, while much of its neighborhood is on fire, has wars. Not a happy image. But if we go back to the more general, I mean, the of European or global picture, certainly there's not a question of going back to something. Because remember that the crisis we're going through within developed countries is the result of colossal, successive political failures. I mean, the world, the developed world, has gone through 20 or 30 years of globalization, technological change, and a neoliberal economic ideology, which has produced the biggest inequalities within countries that we have experienced for decades, number one. Number two, the biggest financial crisis since 1929. And then a distribution of the pain after the crisis, which has absolutely no resemblance or no correspondence to the distribution of gain before the crisis. And then you are surprised that there are many people who are angry. The trouble is that we are probably in an age where those who have legitimate reasons to be angry do not have a credible alternative solution as yet. And this is probably where we are. But there is no doubt that the previous era is coming to an end because it has produced many huge failures. I mean, some friends of mine, a friend of mine, in fact, who is Scottish, told me that the Brexit victory was based on an unholy alliance, and I thought it was very pertinent, of members of English golf clubs, so the people who are nostalgic of the British Empire and who often live in the British countryside and think of a world that simply is gone, with the sans-culottes of the modern version of sans-culottes, the losers of globalization. And there was an extraordinary alliance of those two very different groups. To some extent, Mr. Trump has succeeded in doing the same. So a billionaire with gilded lifts and airplanes has convinced a large section of white male workers in the States, who are great losers of what has been happening in the last 30 years, that he will protect them. Now, Greece somehow doesn't fit very well into that because Greece is not an industrial country. It has lost much of its industry. Greece has a different kind of problem. I mean, it doesn't have the typical losers of globalization because Greece never had even a neoliberal model, all right? So many of them are losers from the application of neoliberal policies. Well, Greece has never had neoliberal policies. You can accuse previous governments in Greece for all sorts of things, but certainly not for being neoliberal. Okay? So I will stop there.
Yeah, I was struck by Mr. Pagulato's observation that people feel that the system is not working for them. Actually, I saw a paper was published by the World Economic Forum about the gains of globalization across the world, and was the lowest class of the European of the West gained, not that much as the biggest class, but gained during the globalization. I mean, everybody gained from globalization. I think that the biggest problem of the people is that they don't understand the system anymore. And my first shock was not Trump in the United States. My first shock was the re-election of George W. Bush in 2004, where he had a simple about the security issues back then, which was the big issue. He had a simple answer: if you are not with us, we're against us. This is a simple thing that people can understand. On the other hand, you had the Democratic nominee, which was John Kerry, who was saying that, yes, we will fight terrorism if the United Nations decide that, if European Union supports us, if Latin America does that, and people were confused. So
there is a structural problem in our modern democracy. Things are becoming more and more and more complicated, even in the procedure of democratic process. I mean, it was different in the 60s when prime minister only with parliament decided, and it's different today that it has the parliament, it has judiciary, independent, it has independent authorities, it has the media, pressure groups. The decision in politics are complicated, and people have less time to understand it. So I think that populism is growing through this chasm between the complication of politics and economy and stuff like that, and the simplicity that people need.
Yeah, it's a form of insecurity.
Probably.
It's a form of insecurity.
Yeah, and that creates a lot of insecurity, and that creates the need to go back where things were simpler and more clear and more stuff. So that's why I believe that we have to go back to the basics, to teach you, the teachers, and we, the journalists, to teach back what is democracy, why democracy is needed, why is complicated, because the more democracy is widening and deepening, to Vathema και το Platyma της Δημοκρατίας, where Andreas Papandreou was saying, the more complicated it's become, because more players are coming in. So we have to explain all this. We have to go back to the basics.
Okay. There was a question by Dimitri Papadimitri about Europeanism in Greece. Is it relatively stronger? My sense is that the reason why it may appear to be relatively stronger is because the trust in domestic institutions is even worse. I mean, you see the statistics of trust in various institutions. It's very low for European institutions, but for domestic, it's even worse. I think that probably in Britain, it's the other way around. So this now, Platontinos mentioned migration. Yes, there's been a huge exit of people who should be or could be building the new businesses in Greece here. However, and it is a blow to our future, no doubt about that. However, the people who are still in Greece, there's a lot of potential from them which has not been realized yet. And my sense is that under the conditions I mentioned before, we will see a lot of people building new business or growing businesses in Greece. And I also see that I also think that some of the diaspora can be very useful in that process, especially in technology and innovative businesses. It's quite a common model to have joint management or founders, one of whom is in New York and one of whom is in Athens or Thessaloniki, and Thessaloniki produces and New York sells. This is already a model that's happening, and we could use the diaspora for that. Now, Yorgos Pagoulatos, of course, tried to darken everybody's soul, but I will valiantly answer. Of course, to codify the question is, what can we do in order to make the middle class support democracy again and be more optimistic? I think it helps to divide the issue. The issue really has two levels. One is the real challenges that people face. Technology, for example, is extremely disruptive for a number of jobs, or globalization. These are the real challenges. And the second is, given those challenges, do we feel that we have agency? Do we feel that we can try and do something about it? Now, these are two separate questions. If you feel that you can try and do something about it, even if the disruption is huge, democracy can be maintained, trust can be maintained, and there can be some sort of reaction that may succeed. Maybe not, but the reaction, the positive reaction will be there. I don't think that the real challenges are that insurmountable. It's important, though, to regain the sense of agency, which has been lost in Greece. How can we do that? I think I would say on three levels. On the level of politics, I would say something very trite. You need new political leaders, new political entrepreneurs who can somehow break from the past dependency, create new narratives, et cetera, et cetera. On the level of entrepreneurs and people who try and start new businesses, as I said before, I think there are opportunities. Let me say one word about tourism. Tourism in Greece has not just been a good tradable sector which brings in money from exports, it has been a stabilizer of democracy, in my opinion, because it has been the one sector where the benefits have been widely distributed through private sector initiatives. There's not much of an oligarchy in tourism. It's widely distributed. And even in the worst times of populism and state corruption, et cetera, tourism, for its own reasons, managed to survive and give people hope that whatever happens in the rest of the society, we can live fairly well. And even today, if you go to tourist places, you don't get the sense of despair that you get in the rest of Greece. I think if we start some, if we see some businesses building up in the towns, in the cities of the types that I was talking about before, in the rural areas, this should provide some sense that of agency, of optimism, by example, by employment, etc. And finally, on the level of intellectuals and academics, I think that what we have to fight, you have to fight, is the post-truth soundbite, the simplifications that have been inundating public discourse these past few years. There's no simple formula for how you do that, but if one focuses mostly into simplifying the answers, but in the direction of some sort of truth or rather some sort of lie, this could perhaps help. And let me finish with one adage that I greatly admire. I was listening to some TED lecture a few years ago, and he was discussing some huge problem. And he said, I'm not sure on this issue if it is the pessimists or the optimists who are right. But I'm sure of this, that it is the optimists who are going to do something about it. So being an optimist is not a matter of whether you're right or wrong, it's rather it's whether you're doing something about it or not. Thank you.
Look, I just want to say one perhaps one thing, because I forgot to answer questions by Dimitris Papadimitriou. How does one explain high levels of support for the euro in Greece? I think the answer could have two legs. One is what Aristos has just mentioned, namely that in Greece, as well as in the whole of the European South, public trust in European institutions is higher than trust in national institutions. And it is exactly the opposite when you move north. And this is a problem at the European level, how to reconcile the two. But there's another factor. If you look at Eurobarometer and all the other kinds of public surveys in Greece, you find that support for European integration has declined dramatically in recent years, but support for the euro remains relatively high. So what is the explanation? A simple explanation would be that the Greeks are becoming schizophrenic or manic depressive. You know, because it was possible, the crisis has created psychological trouble. I think there's a much simpler explanation. It is that love for the euro, it's not love for the euro, it's fear. It's fear of the alternative. So decline in support for European integration goes hand in hand with the fear of the large majority of Greeks that outside the euro, life will be even worse. And as long as that persists, this is going to be a constraint on domestic politics. If that goes, then...
So it's a constraint of fear.
Yes. Though. Yeah, it's fear rather than love.
Well, thank you very much. Kevin, would just like to say a few words before we close today's proceedings.
Well, what a high-quality set of discussions we've had from each of the panels. I think it's been a marvelous discussion that we've had. And I guess themes like modernity, modernization have defined a struggle for Greece from the very beginning and obviously seem to continue to do so today. It's also perhaps curious that in some respects it's easier for Greeks to talk about modernity and modernization outside Greece. It's instructive, of course, that we had the conference here, or the LSE had the conference here 20 years ago, and we're now commemorating that. It's pleasing that the LSE and the Hellenic Observatory has been able to have this kind of discussion. It's pleasing that several of people have said that this is an easier place to have the kind of discussion we've had today. It certainly reinforces the very purpose, the very rationale of having the Hellenic Observatory, so that is greatly welcomed. For a small team in the observatory, then an event like this, of course, is a huge undertaking. And so I think it would be appropriate for me to finish by recognizing the tremendous efforts that a number of my colleagues have made. And I'm going to invite you to thank Ioana, Alex, Ismini, Spiros Economides, the director of the Hellenic Observatory, our team of student helpers, Angelos, Katerina, Michalis, et cetera, too many for me to mention. But it is a team which works extremely well, and I'm extremely grateful to them. Can you please join me in thanking them? Of course, 20 years ago, when the Hellenic Observatory held this conference, I was just a mere child. I don't think I was even born 20 years ago. But the observatory seems to be, I think, in good health, and therefore, let's hope the next 20 years go at least as well. In order to celebrate our 20th birthday party, as it were, you are all invited now to join us at a reception which is downstairs in the senior common room, and we can continue our discussions there. But thank you very much for all of your participations, and to our speakers, each of the speakers of each of the panels, a fantastic set of discussions. Thank you very much indeed.